This is Puget Sound Now, a look inside the issues happening in our communities around the Sound.
Groundhog Day means we're a little closer to a popular Valentine's Day dash promoting heart screenings and transplants.
In hopes that other people become organ donors and just more familiar with organ donation and what that looks like to become a donor.
Alexander's hope helps to save young lives. A new drug shows promising results for children born with dwarfism.
In the pediatric world, infants with achondroplasia can develop life-threatening spinal cord compression, which can result in sudden infant death syndrome.
Realities and misconceptions about little people. Good morning, Bill Swartz on this first Puget Sound Now in February, a month filled with holidays and some special elections. The Issaquah School District asking voters to approve a bond measure to fund construction of a fourth high school. Hey, did you know many King County registered voters right now are in the middle of an important election? They're choosing a board member for the King Conservation District. Now, what is KCD? Why should you be interested? How do you vote? We have some answers just ahead as we spend a few minutes with Rosa Mendez Perez, Executive Director of the King Conservation District. Also, Mark Dostal is the Community Engagement Director for the program, too. Thank you both for being here on Puget Sound Now.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So King Conservation District is a non-regulatory special purpose district funded by a lot of our listeners. Rosa, a little bit of the history. What's the mission behind this organization?
To work with the community members in the county to implement conservation projects. We provide services that benefit everybody in the county, and that includes clean water, increased tree canopy, and stronger local food systems that benefit us all. But we do this by working directly with individuals and cities to solve those conservation issues. And our programs work both in urban and rural communities, and all of it is through voluntary partnerships.
Mark, how big an area are we talking about that folks are involved in this?
Yeah, so King Conservation District represents more or less all of King County, with the exception of a few localities that have opted not to be in the King Conservation District. So for the most part, if you're in King County, you're eligible to vote in our district, with the exception of the cities of Enumclaw, Federal Way, Milton, Pacific, and Skykomish, that have chosen not to participate in the district.
So it's a vast area. One of the programs has a way to promote better soil. We talked about, these vast areas, but just your own backyard. That's one part of King County Conservation District, or King Conservation District. People can actually have their soil tested. How do they do that?
They can collect their soil samples and either drop them off right at our office or send them to us, and then we send them out for testing and provide them with the results. And there are some directions that we'd like you to follow, and all of that is available on our webpage. And these are directions that help us make sure that we're sending the right amount and collecting the soil in the appropriate way for the lab that we use to perform the testing.
What's in it for me? What's in it for my neighbors downstream if I know what kind of soil I have?
Well, it really will help you if you're looking at what kinds of plants you'd like to plant in your backyard, if you're looking at the kind of food production in your backyard to make sure that there isn't anything in your soil that would make it not safe to eat the food directly from your own backyard. And for your neighbor, I think if you're sharing that food and maybe sharing tips on how you're growing plants and food in your backyard, we really pride ourselves on working with individuals. And one of the best ways to spread the message of conservation is by peer-to-peer learning. So we love it when neighbors help other neighbors based on what they've learned from the conservation district.
I have two apple trees, and it was a bad spring and summer for them, as we know, for a lot of the crops in our area. The climate is an impact. That said, we've had a lot of wildfires that have creeped into our urban areas. How does King Conservation District help property owners clear space and make their areas more safe?
We do have a program that focuses on wildfire resiliency, and a lot of that is through education. So we'll do presentations, we'll come out and work with either a homeowner association or other communities in a way that teaches them the best practices for protecting their homes.
I know when my kids were in school, we did a lot of stream restoration. Mark, is that part of the effort of King Conservation District as well? I know you had a great program up at Thornton Creek in North Seattle.
Yeah, King Conservation District has multiple programs that focus on stream and marine shoreline restoration and enhancement, both in the urban and rural communities. You can find more information about all of that at kingcd.org. We have wonderful technicians who are extremely knowledgeable, and KCD provides sort of the full gamut of services from education to technical assistance, and we can even help people with cost sharing to offset the costs of project implementation.
Why is it vital to take away invasive ivy or other noxious weeds and make sure that the native plants flourish, especially near creeks?
Well, we are very cognizant of the salmon in our communities. And when we work with streamside property managers, we're really looking at how we can get those native plants to take root and propagate because they provide a lot of benefits to the salmon and other critters in the area. They provide habitat, they provide shading and cooling. And it's one of our favorite things to do is work on those stream restoration projects.
We have Rosa Mendez-Perez and Mark Dostal with the King Conservation District as our guests this morning on Puget Sound Now. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of this important election for a board of supervisor, give us a few examples of the positive work of KCD, the volunteers, how we are improving our local environment.
We call them our implementation teams, and they're working in both urban and rural communities. So they can work with producers, so on farms, with writing farm conservation plans. We also work with jurisdictions and looking at things such as tree canopy and doing tree plantings. We've held a couple of those over the last few months. And we also work on streamside projects as we just discussed. And one example is in Kirkland at Cafe Juanita. That was a very popular streamside restoration because of the access that people have with the restaurant and being able to see that streamside restoration up front and personal.
Mark, I saw your article about the native plant sale that happened last year. That's part of a fundraiser, I'd imagine, but it's also a way for people to get these good plants into their backyards and their properties.
Yeah, that's true. Every year, KCD runs a native plant sale. We primarily sell plug and bare root stock into the communities. We're typically selling about 70, just shy of 70,000 native plants a year. Local or native trees, shrubs, and ground covers for people in the community to put into their backyards or do their own sort of restoration and enhancement projects with.
And talk to me about your education programs, especially in the schools where young people are learning about being good stewards of our environment.
We do a lot of education programs, and some of them are available virtually on our website. We record when we have those events, but we also have some that are created just for virtual viewing so that anyone who wants to learn a little bit more about either soil sampling or tree canopies or even invasive species control, they can access that on our webpage. But we do also have in-person events where we'll tour a project that was completed. So it shows that peer-to-peer education model where you can see work that your neighbor has done with our technical assistance.
King Conservation District is always listening to its patrons, its investors, about ideas, but you also have a board of supervisors, and right now there is an election for one position. Tell me why this board of supervisors, I think there are five of them, are so essential for the program.
Our board of supervisors are there to help us determine our priorities. They approve our budget every year. So they really set the guideposts for the work that the conservation district implements. And that's why we are really grateful that we have the opportunity to spread the word about our election, because we think it's really important that residents participate in that election so that they're taking a part in conservation in their communities.
I received my voter card in the mail, and it has a QR code to scan to participate. If somebody did not get a card in the mail and they would like to be involved in this, exercise their constitutional right, how can they do so?
We have always the option of mailing anyone a physical ballot if that is the way they'd like to vote, and they can simply get in touch with our office and we will make sure we mail a ballot out to you.
Okay, so hopefully everybody is aware now of King Conservation District. Thank you so much, Rosa Mendez-Perez, Mark Dostal, for enlightening us about King Conservation District today on Puget Sound Now.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's been estimated 50,000 people in the United States have dwarfism, a medical condition making them shorter and creating health complications and some life challenges. Our guest on Puget Sound Now this morning, an expert on achondroplasia, the most common form of dwarfism. Dr. Clayne White is chair of the Pediatric Orthopedics at Children's Hospital of Colorado, and he was director of orthopedic research at Seattle Children's Hospital. Thank you so much for the conversation.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Doctor, what do we know about the causes of achondroplasia?
Achondroplasia is the most common form of short-limbed dwarfism, and this results from a change in one of the genes that we have. We have over 23,000 genes, but this one is specifically important in mediating growth in our skeleton, the arms and legs, and to a lesser extent, the spine, which results in an average stature in men of about 4 feet, 4 inches tall, and in women about just over 4 feet. So people with achondroplasia do live happy and productive lives, but for many tasks, they rely on adaptive equipment for activities of daily living, such as driving, shopping, and other forms of self-care.
Is there a way to detect achondroplasia before birth?
It can be detected for birth. Most commonly is detected after the children are born. It's usually fairly recognizable to someone who's seen achondroplasia. It can be picked up on prenatal testing, either genetic testing. For most infants, though, it doesn't really become apparent by ultrasound until the third trimester, when most women are not getting routine ultrasounds. They usually get their routine ultrasounds around 20 weeks, so in the second trimester.
Is that something that could be detected in a blood test, checking for chromosome and DNA?
Yeah, certainly a DNA test can be performed. We're getting better at some of these DNA tests. I'm not a geneticist, so I don't want to speak too much off what the technologies are these days, but it definitely can be tested by gene testing.
So after birth, doctor, what are some of the early signs parents will notice? What steps should they take to have their child diagnosed and treated?
Yeah, I mean, really, the signs can be relatively subtle. All infants have relatively large heads and short limbs. It's probably a little bit more pronounced in children with achondroplasia. The primary difference is that because of the gene difference, the bones grow less slowly, but the amount of skin and soft tissue tends to be on the same. So they tend to have a little bit more fat rolls, The term, it kind of looks a little bit like a little Michelin man, if I can say so. Mm-hmm. And that, again, becomes apparent to someone who's seen them before. I think most importantly is that once it's recognized that these patients are referred to a center that has expertise in the care of these children.
That's what leads to my next question. Are primary care physicians trained to diagnose and treat dwarfism because it's such a rare disease?
You know, they, like everything else, we all learn a little bit about everything when we're training. I will say, though, that, for these rare conditions, pediatricians do learn about them, but their exposure is probably somewhat limited. It depends on where you train and with whom you train. But I will say that most pediatricians are pretty good at recognizing it, certainly achondroplasia.
Our guest on Puget Sound Now this morning, Dr. Clayne White, the chair of pediatric orthopedics at Children's Hospital of Colorado, and he did some important work here at Seattle Children's Hospital as well. What are the realities then, the misconceptions of people living with achondroplasia?
Yeah, I think it's important to address the reality that while adults with achondroplasia are shorter than the average adult, they tend to do quite well in the world. They live their daily lives much like you and I do. They have jobs, they have families. They go on vacations and do all the stuff that we do. And so the misconception is that simply being short statured is a significant disability, which ultimately it's not the short stature that causes the problems, it's the associated health issues.
Of course, the great composer Randy Newman had a hit song, Short People, and I'm sure there are a lot of jokes, there are a lot of stereotypes that people with dwarfism face on an everyday basis, aren't there?
Sure. And I'm sure that song is not the favorite song amongst our little people community. For anyone who looks a little different, they're going to face biases. That's the reality of our world. And I think it's important to dispel some of the myths and misconceptions that we've already talked about. There's some terminology that's really appropriate for little people. That is the term they prefer. Sometimes they'll shorten it to LP. They are okay with dwarf or dwarfism.
You spoke about the everyday challenges. Now, people living in wheelchairs have specially designed homes, ramps, etc., to help with everyday movements and tasks. Are they doing the same for people with dwarfism?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's the concept of you can adapt the person to meet their environment, or you can adapt the environment to meet the person's needs. And I think both go on. It really depends on what situation you're talking about. When we talk about children going to school or adults going to work, you know, there can be accommodations made in terms of lowering counters, lowering sinks. The converse would be to, you know, provide step stools and that sort of thing, or appropriately sized desks. People who have who are little people who have short stature will famously rebuild their houses to have short, you know, lower cabinets, lower tables, and so forth. So I think there's different ways to go about this.
What can a person do when they encounter a little person without, you know, hurting their pride? Let's say I'd like to help you reach something that's out of reach. Is that appropriate?
If someone looks like they're having a hard time and would look like they would appreciate a hand, I think that's okay. I don't think that necessarily puts people off. These are people with normal intelligence. They live normal lives. They go out in the world. They know how to navigate the world for the most part. So usually they don't really need a lot of help. If they're going to the grocery store and they know they need to reach to a high shelf, they usually have something that will help them to reach what they need to reach. So, but you know, I think just being polite and kind is, you know, sort of kindergarten rules, and applies to little people as well.
Treat people the way you would like to be treated. Finally, what are some of the health complications we typically associate with achondroplasia?
Yeah, I think this is a really important topic to review, because specifically in the pediatric world, infants with achondroplasia can develop life-threatening spinal cord compression, which can result in sudden infant death syndrome. The rate of sudden infant death syndrome in children with achondroplasia has been measured to be as high as 7%. So 7 out of 100 babies can die of this condition. As they grow older, they can have more ear, nose, and throat problems. They can have ear infections. They can have what we call obstructive sleep apnea, where they have a little bit excess tissue in the back of their throat, and so they have a problem breathing at night. And they, you know, in my world, I'm a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, so they can have bowing of their legs. They can have spine problems as children. I think the other important aspect is as they become adults, the narrowing of their canal because of the lack of growth of their spinal canal can result in pinching of the nerves as it leaves the spinal canal, which, if left untreated, can result in weakness and disability and pain.
So what I'm hearing from you is that many could face some surgeries throughout their life to try and alleviate pain or just walk more normally.
Yeah, at present, the way we treat most of these situations, other than, you know, the surveillance and monitoring, is primarily through surgical interventions. With that said, there are some new treatments that are coming out, which we are hopeful will help some of these health conditions. Right now, they're really aimed at accelerating growth. But we are hopeful that there will be some secondary benefits in terms of these other health issues that we've discussed.
And where can our listeners go to educate themselves about this condition?
Well, first and foremost, I would always recommend that your listeners start with their local healthcare providers. We have a great website here at Children's Colorado with a robust amount of educational materials. Alternatively, I would refer people to Little People of America, or LPA online. And finally, risinglove.com, which is a great resource provided by BioMarin.
Is there a support network for little people? Do they have Facebook and social media gatherings?
Little People of America is a very large organization. It's very inclusive. They have national meetings yearly. They also have local and regional meetings. And for your audience in Seattle, I can shout out the LPA chapter and the Northwest region as being one of the strongest LPA communities out there.
That is great to know. Dr. Clayne White has been our guest on Puget Sound Now, speaking about dwarfism this morning. And thank you so much. Take care.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
They have a new location for a popular run-walk, the same mission for an important organization. Alexandra's Hope is a local nonprofit dedicated to life-saving cardiac testing, CPR, and organ donations. And coming up next Saturday, February 8th, it's the annual Valentine's Day Dash, this time in downtown Bellevue. Back with all of the details, our friend, the founder of Alexandra's Hope, Bella Chafee, and it's great to catch up on Puget Sound Now.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to share about the Dash a little bit more and the new location. We have the full course up on our website as well, which is alexandershope.org, if you want to check that out. But the start and finish is at Bellevue Downtown Park, which is a super, super cool spot to be able to be at.
Let's start with your journey. Now, folks are familiar because they've been listening to this show the past 3 or 4 years, but Alexandra's Hope was founded after your brother Alexander's health issues were detected.
Yes. So my brother Alexander suffered from a undiagnosed and then misdiagnosed heart condition when he was 19 years old, which ultimately, due to the amount of time it took to figure out what was wrong with him, which was a lot in part due to his young age, he ended up needing to have a heart transplant.
He was a cross-country runner, right? And then in 2011 had some chest pains, some strange stuff going on. And the first doctor said everything's checking out. But as you said, could it have been diagnosed with a proper cardiac screening at the time?
It would have been. So he had a bicuspid aortic valve. And that was the, you know, initial issue that caused his bigger issues later on. But had that been caught when he was younger, they would have looked at him a lot more seriously, and he should have needed a valve replacement, which is still a big deal, but not nearly as big of a deal as a heart transplant.
On your website, as you said, alexandershope.org, is a great testimonial from Alexander. 2017, he was only on the transplant list for about, 8 days before the heart transplant, and I'm sure he was one of the lucky ones, because 95% of all Americans believe in organ donations, but only 54% are organ donors.
That is true. We thought he ended up getting a total artificial heart put inside of his chest. So his heart was taken out, the total artificial heart was put in. And then once he was stable on that, that's when they put him on the transplant list. And we were getting prepared to have him be that on the list for a very, very long time, because oftentimes you are. And they have ways now where you can, you know, go home with the total artificial heart and like backpack form, which is really great. But also your quality of life is, it's tough. But that was what we were preparing for and what he was preparing for when miraculously he was able to get a transplant earlier.
How rare is it to receive a match like that?
You know, I don't have the stats backing me, but I would say pretty rare. We were told probably about a year.
I believe it. What did Alexandra and your family learn more about organ donation and the process?
I mean, we learned a ton. We knew nothing, right, about the process. We became more informed about, like you had mentioned earlier, just the statistics on surrounding organ donation. And there's a lot of things out there, and we were reading up on them, and we're like, this doesn't make any sense, you know? And there is just so much there. And when you're in it in the moment, it's just, there's so much to learn. And then also just the way you get on the transplant list and that you're able to go home and things like that is like a total artificial heart was not something we ever knew about before.
Our guest on Puget Sound Now this morning, Bella Chafee, founder of Alexandra's Hope, their big fundraising event, Valentine's Day Dash, coming up Saturday, February 8th, but the first time in downtown Bellevue Park. How easy is it, Bella, to become a registered organ donor?
It is super easy. There is websites you can go on to sign up. And then what you'd want to do is change on your driver's license. But I know that nobody really wants to go into the DOL just to change when they don't have to. You will be able to become an organ donor online. And that technically has you as an organ donor. But then whenever you eventually have to go into the DOL to change your driver's license, I would update it. I would recommend to update it there as well.
If a young person becomes an organ donor, why is it really important for them to let their family members know that they've done that?
So if something were to happen to you, a tragedy, and you were in a position to be able to donate your organs, it's a really tough spot for family members to be in. And they're not expecting to be in that position at all. And they're grieving, and it's hard to educate people at that time as well and know the appropriate way to be able to communicate with them. Being able to make that decision for your family ahead of time so that they know what your wishes are is really beneficial for your family. And then if you did choose to become an organ donor, that's also beneficial for so many other people and families as well.
As a guy who's covered sports much of my career, I'm very familiar that sudden cardiac arrest is a big deal for athletes, especially young people from the high school to college level. And your organization is really partnering with Nick of Time, kind of a tandem thing to get EKG screenings. What's that all about?
So Nick of Time is awesome. We partnered with them really like as soon as we became a nonprofit, we found out about them and they were doing a lot of what we wanted to do. And it made more sense for us to partner up together. And so they've been doing it a lot longer than we have. They go to high school about once a month and screen kids for undiagnosed heart conditions. So they're partnering with UW Medical Center. They each kid that goes through is getting educated on CPR and how to operate an AED. They're also getting an EKG done and then sitting down with a doctor to go over those findings. And if there is something that, you know, it could just be a family history or something they want to look at more, they will do an echo on the spot. If there is a potential issue, they will then have the child go into the doctor and get checked out. And I think it's about one in every 300 kids ends up having an issue, a bigger issue. And I think one in every 50 kids, a smaller issue is found. One in every 300, a bigger issue is found. And we're able to screen roughly, it really depends on the school that we're at, but roughly 500 kids every single screening. And we just had our largest screening ever at Ballard High School earlier this month. And we screened just under 700 kids, which was huge.
That is fabulous. And there is a screening coming up at Mount Si High School in Snoqualmie, Wednesday, February 5th. And then the really large one is at the Seahawks headquarters, the VMAC, in Renton, March 8th. So you can get more details on their website, nickoftimefoundation.org. But we're going to focus in on Alexander's Hope today with Bella Chafee. You have a testimonial page. People's lives have been saved and changed, not only through heart transplantation, but it's organs of all different kinds of varieties, hearts, kidneys, livers. And I think that's fabulous that people are not only donors, but recipients are there to talk about it.
It's been pretty incredible the amount of people that have come forward wanting and willing to share their story so that in hopes that other people become organ donors and just more familiar with organ donation and what that looks like to become a donor.
So the Valentine's Day Dash began in Kirkland, one of my favorite little towns, last year in Redmond, and now it's gone to the Bellevue Downtown Park. You start at 9 a.m. Saturday the 8th, start and finish there at the park. Do you have a course all mapped out?
We do. There is a course. If you go to alexandershope.org, there's a Valentine's Day Dash tab on there. And that has all of our, you know, frequently asked questions, sign up, all that kind of stuff, as well as a link to a PDF, which will show you the whole course.
So you can bring your child in a stroller, which I'm sure you're going to do, your dog, your cat on a leash. What other things do we need to know about the event?
So it is family friendly. We do have special pricing for youths 10 and under so that you can hopefully bring your whole family with you if that's what you want to do. As you mentioned, we are stroller friendly, dog friendly if they're well behaved. And we also have a free kids dash for kids 5 and under at 8:45. So it's a really small, you know, tiny little loop that we do within the park just before the 5K kicks off to include all of the family members, which they have a lot of fun with. And then every participant is getting a long sleeve t-shirt and a medal. And then we have a ton of really awesome sponsors that will be doing some awesome giveaways and prizes as well.
Any speakers there? And is there a way to register to become an organ donor?
So we have a link on our website to Donate Life, and that is the best way to go on to become an organ donor. And we will have information on that at the race as well. Probably just a QR code that you're able to scan, as well as a link in an email that will go out. And then as far as speakers go, we will have some, you know, great MCs going over what, you know, Alexander's Hope is and how we work with the Nick of Time Foundation and organ donation, all that great stuff. So there will be some educational portions to it as well.
Sounds like a fabulous event. Again, it's coming up Saturday morning, February 8th in downtown Bellevue Park, start and finish. And all of the details are at alexandershope.org. The founder of this great nonprofit has been with us this morning on Puget Sound Now. Bella Chafee, wishing you all the best.
Thank you so much.
Many thanks to all of my guests and you for listening. Puget Sound Now is on the podcast page of nwnewsradio.com. I'm Bill Swartz, and we're back again next Sunday morning.
Thank you for listening to Puget Sound Now. Tune in every Sunday morning to learn about the issues happening in our communities around the Sound. Puget Sound Now is a public service of Lotus Seattle Corp.